Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shemini. This week, I'd like to call your attention to the Shavuot retreat at Camp Ramah Darom in Georgia. Pardes will be hosting this conference May 18th through 22nd. It's going to be a great time and will feature Rabbi Meir Schweiger, Rabbi Sarah Mulhern, Rabbi William Friedman, and Rabbi Yaffa Epstein will all be there leading classes and Chavruta study for you and your family. We urge you to check it out, all the details. Find them on the Pardes website, pardes.org.il. Check it out. You'll have a great time. This week, Shemini with Rabbi Michael Hatton. Rabbi Michael Hatton is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
Parshat Shemini begins with the service of the eighth day that marks the completion of the week-long sacrificial ceremonies associated with the dedication of the Mishkan. The untimely demise of Aaron's two eldest sons, who presented an unauthorized offering of incense before God, is then described, followed by a divine injunction forbidding the consumption of intoxicants by the ministering priests. Some details of sacrificial law follow before the Torah moves on to introduce the laws of permitted animals, birds, and fish in chapter 11. These laws, known as the laws of Kashrut, have occupied a central position in Jewish ritual observance, and to this day they are one of the defining marks of a traditional Jewish home. But surprisingly, the text of the Torah itself provides scant, if any, rationale for the performance of these laws, and is content to simply state them as a divine fiat. This week we will consider some attempts of the early commentaries to comprehend these provisions. When one discusses the rationale of the mitzvot, one necessarily must begin with the Rambam, Maimonides. Perhaps more than any other scholar, the Rambam stressed the central role of human reason in the forging of a connection with the Creator and in the fostering of one's spiritual development. He himself also went farther than any other traditional thinker in applying the logic of the mind to the matter of the mitzvot, sometimes arriving at conclusions that were not only novel, but also controversial. His noble attempt to wed the Torah's provisions with classic Aristotelian constructs aroused admiration in some Jewish circles, but enmity and antipathy in others. Nevertheless, in retrospect, no serious discussion of the rationale of the mitzvot can begin from any other point of reference, because the influence of the Rambam on all subsequent discussion was profound. All those that came after him either adopted and amplified his theories, or else consciously reacted against and rejected them. Before we consider the words of the Rambam, let us briefly outline the laws of forbidden foods as the Torah describes. We may divide the matter into a number of subcategories. The land animals, to be fit for consumption, must possess two qualities. They must have holy split hooves, and they must chew their cud. These two provisions effectively limit the matter to herbivores, for they alone have the complex, multi-chambered stomach that allows for rumination. With respect to sea creatures, only those that have fins and scales can be eaten. This effectively limits the matter to certain species of fish and excludes all of the shelled creatures, the aquatic mammals, and the species such as sharks. Concerning the birds, the Torah spells out 20 specific kinds that may not be consumed. The common denominator of them all is that they are birds of prey. Based upon this list, the Talmud attempted to provide a series of features that could be said to characterize the permitted kosher birds, namely, that they possess an extra talon above the others, a digestive crop, and a gizzard whose skin could be easily peeled off. As for the insects, while the Torah permits a limited number of species from the grasshopper and locust families, they are generally avoided by most Jews due to uncertainties concerning their proper identification. It is in his Guide to the Perplexed that the Rambam sets out his views concerning kashrut. I would say that all of those things that the Torah forbade us to consume are nutritionally harmful. Only the pig and the fats may be imagined to not be detrimental, but this is not so. The flesh of the pig is more moist than is beneficial and contains much superfluous matter. But even more than that, the Torah abhorred its consumption because of its great filth and because it feeds on filthy things. if we would raise pigs for consumption, then the marketplaces and even the houses would become filthier than the latrine, as may be seen at present in the lands of the Franks. Similarly, the fat of the intestines is overfilling and difficult to digest, producing cold and thick blood. Blood on the one hand and carcasses of dead animals on the other are difficult to digest and nutritionally poor. It is well known that a beast possessing a congenital defect is akin to a carcass. Therefore, concludes the Rambam, concerning the signs that mark a permitted animal, namely chewing the cud and split hooves for the land animals, and fins and scales for the fish, realize that their existence is not the reason for their permitted status, nor their absence the reason for their forbidden status. Rather, they are the signs by which one may distinguish the healthy species from the unhealthy. Moreh HaNivuchim, Section 3, Chapter 46. In essence, Rambam understands that the rationale that stands behind the Torah's involved legislation concerning consumption is the physical health of the human body. Many foods are wholesome, some are harmful, but all of the various species proscribed by the Torah are nutritionally poor and deleterious to human health. The signs that the Torah provides, effectively allowing us to separate those species that we may eat from those that we may not, are just that, signs. There are no magic qualities associated with split hooves and rumination, or else fins and scales. And if creatures possessed of these things are permitted to us, because of them, actually, these features are meant to provide us with a convenient mechanism for readily recognizing those species that are good for us physically, while avoiding those creatures whose consumption is liable to bring us harm. The advantages of the Rambam's thesis are apparent. First of all, it is eminently reasonable. Living as we do in such health-conscious times, who among us could argue that physical health is an important matter that deserves divine attention as much as anything else? After all, in the case of most of us, only a healthy body can sustain and nurture a healthy mind. As the Rambam himself points out elsewhere, when a person is preoccupied in this world with illness, warfare, or hunger, then he cannot devote himself to the acquisition of wisdom and to the performance of the mitzvot, by which one merits life everlasting in the world to come. Mishneh Torah, Laws of Teshuvah, Chapter 9, Paragraph 1. Second of all, Rambam's theory is able to explain the entire gamut of kashrut laws with a single underlying principle. Whether we are speaking of the non-kosher species of animals, fish and birds, whether we are addressing some constituents of the permitted animal species, such as their blood and their intestinal fat, whether we are considering even kosher animals in various states of decline, such as the trefa, suffering from a congenital defect, or else decay, the nevela, which is a carcass, the rationale for the prescription of all of them is the same, according to the Rambam. They are unhealthy and therefore injurious to our physical well-being. But at the same time, the drawback of the Rambam's explanation is a function of this very reasonableness. If it is the case that the non-kosher species are forbidden because they are harmful to our physical health, then such effects ought to be easily demonstrable in the laboratory. It should be obvious to all and empirically verifiable that those individuals that are attentive to the dictates of kashrut are physically healthier than those that are not. Yet, as we all know, such is not necessarily the case. Numerous are those that do not subscribe to the constraints of kashrut and yet are physically healthy, active, and fit. Surely as well there are those who are careful in their observance of these laws and yet suffer from physical infirmity and illness. It is the Sefer HaChinuch, a 14th century champion of reason and of the Rambam, that comes to his defense, discussing the matter from a perspective that was clearly drawn from the Rambam's theory. The Sefer HaChinuch relates, at the foundation of this mitzvah is to realize that the body is an instrument for the soul, for through its agency the soul can execute its mission. In its absence, its objective can never be completed. After all, truly the soul entered the body for its benefit and not for its detriment. For God does good to all. If the body is deficient in any respect, then the ability of the mind to fulfill its task is curtailed to a corresponding degree. degree. And therefore the Torah distanced us from all things that bring the body ruin. In a straightforward way, then, we may argue that this is the underlying rationale for all of the forbidden foods. But if there are some things among these laws whose harmful effects are not known, neither to us nor to the physicians, do not be perturbed. For the faithful physician who forbade them to us is more wise than either us or them. How foolish is the one who thinks that a thing's injurious or beneficial qualities are a function solely of what he has understood concerning them. Sefer HaChinuch, Mitzvah number 73. In other words, the fact that Rambam's thesis may not be demonstrable need not necessarily unnerve us. If the physician with a definite article, that is to say God, indicates to us that certain foods are injurious to our health, then we can rely on his assessment more than on that of any earthbound doctor. After all, God's laws are given to us from his perspective of absoluteness. Our human view, on the other hand, though it may be sharply focused by great and perceptive minds, cannot hope to possibly match the divine mind for acuity. Essentially, the Sefer HaChinuch argues that our inability to demonstrate the health benefits of kashrut need not be an impediment to observing them. As an illustration of his premise, one need not look any farther than the various remedies, cures, and diets that were once regarded by medical science as healthy, and yet now may be considered to be otherwise. Even the ubiquitous food pyramid, for example, evolved over the decades, not only as a function of the various agricultural lobbies that underwrote its development, but also as a function of updated data. It was not that the opinion of the medical practitioners abruptly and inexplicably changed, but rather that new information and knowledge brought new insight and understanding to the discussion. In essence, the Sefer HaChinuch in his comments rescues the Rambam's thesis. And as I said, all subsequent thinkers on the subject will either adopt the Rambam's view or react against it. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hatton. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.